Ezekiel chapter 1, in the 30th year, in the fourth month, on the fifth day, while I was among the exiles by the Kebar River, the heavens were opened and I saw visions of God. On the fifth of the month, it was the fifth year of the exile of King Jehoiachin, the word of the Lord came to Ezekiel the priest, the son of Buzi, by the Kebar River in the land of the Babylonians. There the hand of the Lord was upon him. I looked, and I saw a windstorm coming out of the north, an immense cloud with flashing lightning and surrounded by brilliant light. The center of the fire looked like glowing metal. And in the fire was what looked like four living creatures. In appearance, their form was that of a man, but each of them had four faces and four wings. Their legs were straight, their feet were like those of a calf and gleamed like burnished bronze. Under their wings, on their four sides, they had hands, the hands of a man. All four of them had faces and wings, and their wings touched one another. Each one went straight ahead. They did not turn as they moved. Their faces looked like this. Each of the four had the face of a man, and on the right side, each had the face of a lion, and on the left, the face of an ox. Each also had the face of an eagle. Such were their faces. Their wings were spread out upwards. Each had two wings, one touching the wing of another creature on either side, and two wings covering its body. Each one went straight ahead. Wherever the spirit would go, they would go without turning as they went. The appearance of the living creatures was like burning coals or fire or like torches. Fire moved back and forth among the creatures. It was bright, and lightning flashed out of it. The creatures sped back and forth like flashes of lightning. As I looked at the living creatures, I saw a wheel on the ground beside each creature with its four faces. This was the appearance and structure of the wheels. They sparkled like chrysolite, and all four looked alike. Each appeared to be made like a wheel intersecting a wheel. As they moved, they would go in any one of the four directions the creatures faced. The wheels did not turn about as the creatures went. Their rims were high and awesome, and all four rims were full of eyes all around. When the living creatures moved, the wheels beside them moved. And when the living creatures rose from the ground, the wheels also rose. Wherever the spirit would go, they would go, and the wheels would rise along with them, because the spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. When the creatures moved, they also moved. When the creatures stood still, they also stood still. And when the creatures rose from the ground, the wheels rose along with them, because the spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. Spread above the heads of the living creatures was what looked like an expanse or a vault, sparkling like ice and awesome. Under the expanse, their wings were stretched out one towards the other, and each had two wings covering its body. When the creatures moved, I heard the sound of their wings, like the roar of rushing waters, like the voice of the Almighty, like the tumult of an army. When they stood still, they lowered their wings. Then there came a voice from above the expanse, over their heads, and they stood with lowered wings. Above the expanse, over their heads, was what looked like a throne of sapphire. And high above, on the throne, was a figure like that of a man. I saw that from what appeared to be his waist up, he looked like glowing metal, as if full of fire. And that from there down, he looked like fire. The brilliant light surrounded him. Like the appearance of a rainbow in the clouds on a rainy day, so was the radiance around him. This was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. When I saw it, I fell face down, and I heard the voice of one speaking. Ezekiel chapter 1, it introduces the book to us. We're going to spend some time on Sunday evening looking at the book of Ezekiel. I don't know how you felt when we announced we're going to do a series on Ezekiel, whether great excitement, whether there's extras of you here this evening just because we're doing the book of Ezekiel, or whether you felt a sense of dread and foreboding, or just apathy and boredom when it came to it. I don't know, and I think the sense of foreboding and dread was certainly in me as a preacher, and I'm sure as Mark too, in approaching the book. But it is an exciting book, and a bit like when we looked at Zechariah, kind of when you start to look at Zechariah, you think, oh, why could we? I remember people saying, why are you doing Zechariah on a Sunday morning? you know, because there's so much going on. But in a way, books like this and books like that, in a way they're easier because there's loads of pictures. Now, of course, there's the detail of working out what the pictures mean and maybe some explanation to give, but it's a lot of fun and it's different to look at a number of pictures as well as a number of words that there are through the book of Ezekiel. It's probably more of a mix than Zechariah. Zechariah was lots of pictures. Ezekiel's a kind of a mix of quite a lot of word sections, which are just kind of words from the Lord. But sprinkled through there quite a lot of various pictures and images and allegories going on, including Ezekiel himself being involved in them. So I really hope and pray that we're going to learn together from the book of Ezekiel about God, about how he's working, and about ourselves. Just to set your watches, we've got to wind back 150 years before Nehemiah. We've had to work our way through kind of Haggai and Esther and Nehemiah. And Esther and Nehemiah kind of sequentially. And we were probably there and we kind of knew where we were. But now you've got to go back 150 years before that to get to the time of Ezekiel. It's a time of great political upheaval and uncertainty, really, throughout the Mideast, and particularly in Judah, which is all that's left of the nation of Israel. Jeremiah has been prophesying there in Jerusalem. Generally, his message has been very badly received. Some of his messages actually burnt before his very eyes. Ezekiel means God will strengthen, but it doesn't feel like that. Ezekiel is born in Jerusalem or Judah. He's a young man from a priestly family, and he's probably heard Jeremiah's preaching, or at least heard of Jeremiah and what he has to say. There have been various disastrous and some slightly better kings in Judah. They've made useless alliances with Assyria and then Egypt. The growing superpower is Babylon, led by Nebuchadnezzar. He's crushed the Egyptians. He wants to make Judah a vassal state. Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, rebels. He's put out of the way. And there is some nobles, who are taken off to Babylon. That includes Daniel and his friends. And then Jehoiachin is on the throne, and he lasts a little while there, but starts to rebel, and after 3 months, Nebuchadnezzar comes in and takes about 10,000, I think the book of 2 Kings is in 2 Kings 24, about 10,000 soldiers, craftsmen, and priests off captivity to Babylon, and including Jehoiachin, who has a reasonable-ish captivity. His successor is King Zedekiah, who has a much worse fate, but that's 5 years to go before that. So that's why Ezekiel is in Babylon. He's not in Judah, he's not in Jerusalem, he's in Babylon. He's on the banks of the Kibar River. He's been taken off by Nebuchadnezzar in what's called the first deportation. There's a sort of mini deportation with Daniel and his friends. There's the first major deportation, Ezekiel, about 10,000 people, 2 Kings 24. And then in about 5 years' time, about 10 years' time from this first deportation, there will be King Zedekiah revolts, Nebuchadnezzar flattens Jerusalem, and we know some of the rest of that story, don't we? They're all taken off into exile. And later God blesses and is able to rebuild under Nehemiah, but it's a time of great devastation for Judah. So Ezekiel, he's been in exile for 5 years, and the day comes when he turns 30. It says in the 30th year, but probably it means, this is verse 1, probably it means in his 30th year. And he's given a vision, he's given a ministry then. In 5 more years... Jerusalem will be flattened, as I've just described. So he's been in captivity 5 years. 5 more years and Jerusalem will be flattened. So he's in that kind of space in between. One deportation, one defeat. 5 years' time, massive deportation, massive defeat to come. Chapter 33 in Ezekiel, because Ezekiel lives through that, will take us beyond that second devastating time for Jerusalem and gives promises beyond that. But for the moment, we're before that. We're sandwiched in between those two times. That's really the background. Unlike some prophecies, there's a lot of detail here, so we can precisely date. I won't give you the number, but there is a number, BC, for when all these things happen, because they're very precisely nailed down by Ezekiel, just so we know where they fit and what's happening to Judah at the time. Really, chapter 1 of Ezekiel is the backdrop to the book of Ezekiel, and it's kind of the backdrop to the whole of history. It's the thing that we sometimes are allowed to see by God to understand history. It's the heavens being opened. It happens here. It happens to some degree to Daniel. It happens in the book of Revelation. We get to see the tapestry from the other side. We're looking on the underside. We see all kinds of confusion. We see all kinds of hanging threads, torn threads. We see all kinds of chaos. We're looking on the underside. And just now and then, throughout the Bible, we're given a glimpse of the tapestry from the other side, and we see the throne room of God. And that is the backdrop to the whole of history. It's the backdrop to the whole of Bible history. And it's kind of the backdrop to the book of Ezekiel. You'll notice as we work through, every now and then, one of these things that's happened in this first chapter kind of reappears, the four creatures or something, the man that's in the first vision, kind of reappears in amongst loads of other words that are being given, just to say, this is the defining narrative, which is God's on the throne, and these other words are coming from the God who's on the throne. Don't forget, God's on the throne. Here's some words about what's going to happen to Judah. But you know, God's still on the throne. And here's what's going to happen after that. But God's still on the throne. And here's the blessing that God's going to bring about. And God's still on the throne. Remember chapter 1. So let's look at the vision for a few minutes. That's the background. Four creatures, four wheels, and the throne of the Lord Almighty. Verses 4 through to 14 are these four creatures. There's a great storm, kind of a lightning storm, a fire storm, and immense cloud. It's bright, just like fire. And in the center of this cloud is human-like figures, with four faces, though, and wings and hands. Just have some sympathy for Ezekiel. He's trying to write down in words this great spectacle. Can you imagine trying to sort of, you know, remember if he's writing it down later or whatever, kind of all the different things that are going on. So he's just saying it as he sees it. So don't try too hard to reconstruct precisely what he sees. He's just saying what he sees, the impressions of what he sees. He sees creatures with four faces, the face of a man. What does man speak about? The image of God, resourceful, intelligent, almost divine. Face of a lion, courage, frightening strength, judgment, rule. The face of an ox, great value. You scaled your wealth on oxen. How many oxen you had was kind of how rich you were. But it's also a sign of fertility and fruitfulness. And then the face of an eagle, swift, regal, but also able to pounce in judgment. This is not so unfamiliar to Ezekiel. Depictions of the gods that other nations worshipped around them, around Judah, would sometimes have these kind of faces or these kind of images. But more than that, it's not so unfamiliar because of the Old Testament temple. You remember when the Ark was built, the Ark of the Covenant, not the Ark that floated, but the Ark of the Covenant, in which some holy things were kept, including the books, the tablets of the law. And over the Ark, well, there were cherubim. And that the idea seems to be that God's presence is above the cherubim, that the cherubim are holding up the Ark. Sorry, not holding up the Ark. They're on top of the Ark, and they're holding up the presence of God. They're beneath the presence of God. And these kind of animals were depicted on various versions, if I could call it that, of the temple, both the original tabernacle and then on through to Solomon's temple. So not so unfamiliar to Ezekiel, and not so unfamiliar in the Bible. I'm not going to look at it now, but Isaiah 6 has creatures like this, described as four living creatures who are worshipping and crying out, "Holy, holy, holy." And then if you look over in Revelation 4, John says, "After this I looked, and there before me was a door standing open in heaven." He's given a window into heaven. And he goes up there, and he sees, verse 3, "One who sat there had the appearance of jasper and carnelian. A rainbow resembling an emerald encircled the throne. Surrounding the throne were 24 other thrones, and seated on them were 24 elders, dressed in white, and they had crowns of gold on their heads. From the throne came flashes of lightning, rumblings and peals of thunder. Before the throne, seven lamps were blazing. These are the seven spirits of God. Also before the throne, there was what looked like a sea of glass, clear as crystal. In the center, around the throne, were four living creatures, and they were covered with eyes in front and behind. The first living creature was like a lion, the second was like an ox, the third had the face like a man, the fourth was like a flying eagle." So they're ideas that wouldn't have been unfamiliar to Ezekiel. They're ideas that are not unfamiliar if you look through the rest of the Bible. But before we try and think, well, what do they mean? Let's just look at the rest of the vision. Oh, this is how people have tried to depict them. There are loads of pictures. Some are completely ridiculous. Some have extremely ridiculous, effeminate-looking men there. And I don't know what he looks like, really. There are some great sort of works of art that try and depict it. This one looks like a kind of weird sort of cart that is kind of supporting the throne, so I didn't like that one much either. This one is a poor resolution, but it looks like a series of gyroscopes that are flying around. There are loads of internet sites that get into the UFO idea, like this or like this, that the wheels are all about UFOs. It's the first sighting of a UFO, did you know? You know, Men in Black was based around these sightings and all that kind of thing. So most of it's not much help, really. It's either at the sort of UFO end or at the extraordinary interpretation end. But they're all trying, I suppose, to visualize. And it's hard to visualize because he's just saying what he sees. There's another much more arty-looking one. And there are loads of videos as well. I haven't got time to watch those now, but there's loads of videos where you can watch animations of them. But I didn't want to show them to you because I thought people might kind of laugh because they just seem a bit strange. Because it's really hard. God chose not to have the scriptures written in the digital age. I wonder why that was. Wouldn't it have been easier for him? Could have sort of whizzed around the world straight away. But he chose not to. Maybe for good reason. Because it's not about images. We're in the kind of age completely of images and depictions and so forth. And words are what was important. And he speaks to us in words. Discuss that when you go home. Okay. We've moved on. Sorry, I wasn't supposed to show you those pictures until I said the other points. We should move on from the four creatures to the four wheels, verses 15 through to 21. On the ground beneath the creatures, maybe their means of transport, but not because they've got wings, are these wheels. Forget about the engineering, you know, how does one connect to the other? What's distinctive about these wheels is that they go in all four directions. What's also distinctive about these wheels is that they are sparkling, verse 16, and that they are high and awesome. That's why I don't like that kind of picture with the little cart wheels on it, because those wheels look like sort of wheelchair wheels or go-kart wheels or something. They don't look high and awesome. But that's what Ezekiel saw, something high and awesome. And I guess anything bigger than anything Ezekiel had ever seen before, and they're intersecting and they go in all four directions, and they're full of eyes all around. There's pretty much only one thing you can think about when you think about eyes, you think about? What do you think about when you think about eyes? You've got eyes. What activity do you think about when you think about sight? Think about seeing. So when you see wheels with eyes on, it must be to do with the fact that the wheels can see, or someone can see everywhere that the wheels are going. That's picked up in that Revelation vision in the book of Revelation, where the creatures themselves have eyes on them as well. So here are these four creatures connected with somehow with these four wheels who can point in all directions and can move really fast. They can go to the four compass points. They can move freely in any direction without having to move. They're an awesome spectacle. But that's not all. Thirdly, the throne of the Lord Almighty, verses 20 through 22 through to 28. The creatures are somehow connected and supporting, although they can sort of drop their wings and it stays there, so they're obviously not supporting it, but they're underneath this great vault. Different translations have different words because they can't quite sum it up. What is it? It's an expanse, it's a vault, it's an arch, it's the sky, it's the thing above them. And above this expanse was a throne. And high above the throne, there was a figure like that of a man. And it's a figure who's glowing and radiant and regal and spectacular, like a rainbow on a sunny day. Beautiful, a reminder of God's covenant promises, but also reflecting the glory that is at the center of the throne. And it's interesting that Ezekiel doesn't faint when he sees these four weird creatures flapping their wings. You'd be scared. And he doesn't faint when he sees this massive set of wheels that can go in any directions, which are awesome. But he does fall down when he sees the man on the throne. And he describes it as the appearance of the likeness of the glory of God. And when I saw it, I fell face down and I heard the voice of one speaking. What does that mean then? And what does it mean to us? What does that vision mean? God's people need a vision of God, don't we? Ezekiel doesn't claim too much. He's quite measured, isn't he? He says, when I saw it, I fell face down. Sorry, just before that. He says, this was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. The appearance of the likeness. What he's saying is, he's not saying this is God. He's saying this is an idea, a vision I was given, which was the appearance of the likeness. It showed me, it looked like, something like what the glory of God's like. But it wasn't really it. It just showed me something of it. Do you get the point? The appearance of the likeness. He's kind of distancing himself and saying, this is not God. This is a vision of God that I saw. Just think for a moment about the creatures. Some people say it expresses the attributes of God. Some people say those four faces express different virtues of the Lord Jesus Christ, which would be true. Some people say that the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, are kind of following after those four faces. I think it goes Matthew the Lion, and then I forget how it goes after that, but some people would say that. I don't see that clearly enough, and there's no way to sort of verify whether that's so or not, really, so I think it's just speculative. What we do know about these four living creatures is that in chapter 10 of Ezekiel, they are identified as cherubim. That doesn't help us much because cherubim are not very well identified in the rest of the Bible, but they do appear in the rest of the Bible. But that's what these four living creatures are. They're cherubim. They guard the temple in chapter 10, just like in the temple of God that was built by the Israelites. They were seated on the ark or placed on the ark and were supporting the throne, kind of guarding the ark and guarding the presence of God. But I think it's better not to try and tie them down to one idea or to one creature, to say, well, one thing I'm looking forward to when I get to heaven is to see cherubim. That will be exciting. I don't think that's the point. I don't think they're supposed to be kind of literal creatures that we're expecting to see at some point. They're expressing something of the character of God worked through his creation. And whether you think of them as being a kind of material creation, or whether you think of them as being spiritual beings, which seems more likely, what it is God working through creation and bringing glory to himself. That's what the cherubim are showing. They're God's power, his presence, his attributes worked through in creation. And really, if you wanted to the eye of someone like Ezekiel to symbolize God's presence and his power and his attributes and his greatness, this was a perfect image. Might seem a bit weird and wacky to us, but it was a perfect image to talk about God acting, God executing his will in the world, through angels at times, through his created order. It all does his bidding. So the focus is not about the creatures, amazing though they might be, bizarre though they are. The focus is not on the creatures, it's on the throne. Because that's where the vision ends, because that's where the power comes from, and that's where the orders come from. And we need a vision of the transcendent, sovereign, ever-present God who really is on the throne. We need to see that, we need to know that. You notice how high it's described. Where are the wheels, mostly? They're on the ground. Where are the creatures? They're above the ground. And then there's the expanse. And then above the expanse is a throne. And then high above is the man who's on the throne. What's that supposed to say to us? God is transcendent. He's above and beyond. He's way up there. Not remote, as we'll see in a moment, but he is way up there in terms of his authority. And the creatures do his bidding. And Ezra, as an exile, needs to realize that God is transcendent and sovereign. There's a danger for him that he sees the local gods as being the most powerful. He's been captured, hasn't he? There are images of gods all around him that he sees where he's living now. And they seem more powerful because they seem to have done the powerful thing, because they won. And we're exiles because we're not home. We're not in the new heavens and the new earth. We're not home yet. We're exiles in this world. And this world seems to hold sway and seems to have the power. And the gods of this world, the gods of technology, the gods of intellectualism, the gods of entertainment, the gods of money, they seem to be the powerful gods. And we see images of them all around. And we need to look up and to see that God's still on the throne. And not only is he transcendent and sovereign, but he's also powerful and present. God transcends, but he's not remote. He's separate. He's not his creation, but he's everywhere. Not contained, and not restrained, but he can go anywhere and can do anything he wants. And those wheels and the whole thing is just great to kind of symbolize that, isn't it? God's will goes anywhere. God's knowledge goes everywhere. What are these creatures able to do? They're able to whiz around. Wouldn't you like to do that? It's like on some kind of science fiction sort of programs, isn't it, where you can whiz. Want to go to Australia? Bang, like that. The wheels whiz, the lightning flashes, and there you are in just a second. It's like God's knowledge and God's power, how God executes in the world. His eyes go everywhere, the wheels go everywhere, the creatures go everywhere. This almighty noise, wham! This is what God's like. There's no technology, even our massive technology, even the internet with its kind of... I'm trying to think of the word for overweight, but I can't think of it. Overweight information. Sort of bloated, that's the word I was thinking of. It's bloated amount of information, this big highway with stuff, and it kind of whizzes around, and news does whiz around the world now, kind of like lightning. But we're still who we are, as finite creatures who, most of us caught a cold over Christmas, and we're limited in time and space. And we're kind of intimidated by the seeming gods of all this technology, but it's nothing compared to the transcendent God, who is above and beyond, but also present everywhere. Perhaps we see that most wonderfully in the man who's on the throne. I'm not told much about that, but just there was a figure on the throne like that of a man, verse 26. From his waist up, he looked like glowing metal, full of fire, and from down, he looked like fire as well. Do you remember Peter and James and John? They went up a mountain, and they saw a man transfigured before them, dazzling. I reckon they thought of this vision, and the ones that Daniel saw. This is the man on the throne. We're just given a hint here. We're not given a full explanation about the coming Lord Jesus Christ, but we're given the idea that it's a man. And what's fascinating is that it's a man on the throne. It's not a king from the earth who's put on the throne. You know, around that time in that culture, then sometimes kings would be considered gods in their life or gods after they died, kind of elevated. But no, there's a man who's on the throne. And that man will come to earth, and he will be present. He will be Emmanuel. He will be God with us. But he will still be the great king. And friends, this evening, we really do need a vision of God, because as we go about our business during this coming week, we will be intimidated by the gods that are around us. And we do need to see that God is on the throne, that he is transcendent, but he's also powerfully present with us. He knows everything. There's nothing about your life circumstances he doesn't know. There's all kinds of intricate things going on in your life. You think about all the things that made you show up at a particular traffic light on a day. Okay, you're there and there's another car in the other junction. Just think all that had to happen, all the cogs that had to turn for that particular car to be there, kind of opposing you on that particular day. Just think what goes into just that tiny bit of history. And then you multiply that across the whole world. All these wheels within wheels. All these cogs that are turning. All this history that is passing by. And God knows all of it. And God is present everywhere. And God rules over all of it. And we need to do what Ezekiel does, which is to fall face down and to get ready to listen. That's what he does. So we need a vision of the transcendent God, but also we need a word from the Lord. What do we need when situations seem perplexing and confusing and when we just don't understand? Actually, what do we need when we think we do understand and we're completely self-satisfied? What we need is a vision of God, yes, but we need the word of God. As I said, this book is a mixture of pictures of various kinds, things that Ezekiel sees, things that Ezekiel acts out, but always explained by the words of God. You know, if you look on sites Dummy's Guide to Ezekiel or something, quick sermons you can write in half an hour on Ezekiel, you get all kinds of weirdos who write about various visions they've seen. And it's pretty cool just, you know, writing your own visions up, because you can make them mean whatever you want. I'd like to think, you know, that this was an angel who was telling me I really should stop eating Diet Coke and, do something else. Or I really should go to Australia. I really shouldn't do the washing up. The thing about the Bible is it's words of explanation. There are visions, and there are occasions when perhaps we're not quite sure what the vision means, but the vast majority is explanation of what God's doing and what God's showing. And it's all there. It's only sometimes we're a bit dim and we can't even see it in some of these visions, but it's all there if we're willing to put the work into it. It's all there, words for us to understand. And that's what a lot of the book of Ezekiel is going to be about, explanations of what's going on, always with the vision in mind. But we need more than a vision of God. We need a word from God. And Ezekiel's going to be a word about judgment and about salvation. It's going to be some tough weeks when the words seem to be all about judgment, and we need to hear that. And there are going to be some weeks when gloriously and amazingly, there's going to be words about blessing from the book of Ezekiel, and we need to hear those too. You see, though, already in this vision, there's emphasis on words. You see, verse 3, the word of the Lord came to Ezekiel, the priest. You see, verse 25, there came a voice from above the expanse above their heads. And then verse 28, I'm humbled, I saw it, I fell face down, and I heard the voice of one speaking. Next week, we're going to look at the he said to me, and what does he say? We need a vision of God, but also we need a word from God. Don't seek a new vision. If God impresses something upon you, some idea, some picture, that may be a good thing. But don't seek a new vision from God. Seek the vision of God that he's given us here in his word. Read and reread the book of Ezekiel and persuade yourself, because it's true, that God's on the throne, high above. And that God is depicted there as a man, because God the Son will come to earth and he will bring a message of judgment and salvation. Have a vision of God that you carry through this week, but also be eager to hear the word of God that explains that vision and explains everything to you. Be so eager, as we were thinking about this morning, to keep listening to the word of God. That's what exiles need. Why is the world like it is? Why am I like I am? What do I need to know? What do I need to keep being reminded of? I need words and words from the Lord, from the scriptures, from the Bible. I need it explained to me because I'm so dim. I need a word from the Lord. I need to humbly throw myself on the ground and say, you're on the throne. Please speak to me. Speak to me as I gather together with my brothers and sisters. Speak to me as I read the word at home. Speak to me as I'm walking about my daily business. Keep speaking to me your words, which explain my life and remind me of what I need to know. That's what Ezekiel sees, a vision of God, and he starts to receive words from God. God grant us to see the vision and to hear the words. Amen.